As a special holiday treat, we now present a frightening story that will haunt you and your children for years to come. To help tell this morose tale, as Frankenstein, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. In the role of Igor, please welcome President George W. Bush. And as the bride of Frankenstein, Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I was working in my office late one night when my eyes beheld a Wall Street fright. Lots of bad loans that were risky debts were crumbling just like the New York Mets.
They needed cash.
They needed monster cash.
They needed cash.
We need it in a flash.
Taxpayers' cash.
Taxpayers' teeth will gnash.
If they sound brash.
But we need monster cash.
We've seen the housing bubble burst. When Congress got involved, it went from bad to worst. If I'd run the Titanic when it's submersed, I'd have yelled bankers and brokers first.
They need some cash.
There'll be a monster clash.
Over this cash.
We need it in a flash.
We want the cash.
If we don't get this cash.
Without that cash.
There'll be a monster crash.
I've studied history and I'm telling you, we beat the Big Depression because of World War II. So now a new solution has occurred to me. About to end this crisis, we start World War III. Or
we get some cash.
Cash, good.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. The program starts out with unaccountable health care. John Hopkins surgeon Marty Macri provides an insider's look at the dangers of a stay in the hospital. He argues that patients are endangered by errors, overtreatment, and a closed-door culture that protects medical practitioners first. He speaks with Richard Davis, president of Washington, D.C.'s Sibley Hospital. And then after that, Dr. Sonia Luberminsky on the myths of happiness. Many of us buy into the common myths about happiness. We often end up feeling that we are destined to always be unhappy. What can we do to avoid these happiness myths and live a happier and more fulfilling lives? Dr. Sonia Luberminsky talks to Tom Hartman on the myths of happiness.
This week, Dr. Marty Macri examines the dangers of a hospital stay in his book, Unaccountable. The Johns Hopkins surgeon provides an inside look at hospital errors, overtreatment, and a closed-door culture that protects medical practitioners. He discusses his findings and experience with President of Washington, D.C.'s Sibley Hospital, Richard Davis.
Hi, I'm Chip Davis, and I'm here today with Marty Macri, the author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. So welcome.
Good to be with you, Chip.
So you're an expert in this field, and I know that you've been focused on it for a while. Tell us a little bit about the reasons that you decided to write the book and some of your findings.
Well, two main drivers that led me to write the book. Number one, patients oftentimes tell me that when they come to the hospital, they feel like they're walking in blind. There's this giant system that they don't know how to evaluate. And when I ask my patients sometimes, why did you choose to come to this hospital? Over my career, I've gotten answers like, the parking here is good. We can do better than that. You know, this is one-fifth almost of the U.S. economy. And competition just seems to be at the wrong level, and patients are frustrated. The other reason I wrote the book is that doctors are getting crushed right now. I mean, they've got declining Medicare payments. They've got increasing overhead. Hospitals have more expenses. Malpractice rates are going up. The burnout rate in healthcare is 46%. Doctors are getting crushed right now. And I just felt like we needed a voice out there, and it's okay to talk to the general public.
So you make the point that medical mistakes, if you will, are the third leading cause of death in the United States. And that's a shocking figure. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was shocking even for me as somebody interested in this field of quality to see it put in that way. Medical mistakes are number three. We kill as many people from medical mistakes as we do from car accidents, another three, four, and five causes of death in the U.S. I guess I've never really thought of it that way because we don't really talk as openly and honestly about mistakes as we should in our profession, to be very blunt. You know, you think about number one, heart disease, number one cause of death in the U.S. We spend a heck of a lot of time and energy on heart prevention and heart disease. Cancer, a ton of money going to cancer. Medical mistakes, we're just now beginning to recognize that this is number three. And some people have told me after I wrote Unaccountable, there's not really a medical mistake problem in the U.S. And I think we're starting to just now accept that this is something we've got to start talking honestly about.
So we know that there's tremendous care that's received here in the U.S., certainly at the institutions that you trained at, but this concept of kind of quality and the disparity of quality, and you got interested in it during your doctoral program at Harvard. Can you talk a little bit about how you came into that and what your interest was, and really where did the field come from?
Well, I think it just started to be recognized as a field when I was a student. It was sort of a right time, right place kind of thing. I had this frustrating experience with a patient of mine that I was assigned to follow. Her name was Mrs. Banks, and she's in the opening of the book. She really didn't want anything done for her cancer, which had spread all over. The doctors clearly wanted to do something. They essentially bullied her or talked her into it. They overstated the benefits and understated the risks, something we know from research happens, especially with those of us that do procedures. It just didn't seem right to me. It seemed as if the profession wasn't telling the truth. It seemed as if the profession of medicine had long strayed from its original mission and its heritage. It's not why I went into medicine, and I just, quite frankly, quit. I started School of Public Health, where I met David Bates and Lucian Leap.
So let me just, I'm sorry, interrupt. So you were in medical school, and you decided you'd had enough, and you went to School of Public Health?
Yeah, I basically explained what Mrs. Banks wanted at our morning conference. They tore me upside down for, you know, explaining to them that she didn't want the procedure done. They basically implied, doesn't matter what she wants, this is what she needs. And this was, to me, a sign of a culture that I had observed sort of from the outside, but didn't want to be a part of. And I quit medical school. And then I started graduate school for public health because I had heard of a tract where you can focus on quality. And there were people now interested in medical mistakes. For the first time, they were describing studies where they were looking at handwriting resulting in patient harm. It was a radical concept at the time. David Bates put a big study out, and he describes the head of one of the largest doctors organizations in the United States calling him and basically saying, what are you doing this for? This is not a problem. And I realized that we have had these explosions of knowledge in medicine, but we have not coordinated care. And all these services that we have end up having so many cracks that the cracks are as harmful as the diseases that we're treating. And you got to step back and ask, you know, are we hurting people overall? I mean, on a global level, what are we doing sometimes? And of course, now we've got the Institute of Medicine report saying 30% of everything we do may not be necessary in healthcare. When we step back, 30% of all the medications we prescribe, the tests we order, the procedures. This is something I think which is, for the first time, really being called out as a problem. Now, people out there in the general public have been saying for a long time, we don't like the closed-door culture of medicine. We find medicine even sometimes to be an arrogant industry. We feel like we don't connect. I remember in medical school being told a nosebleed was epistaxis. And I said, well, isn't that a nosebleed? And they said, no, that's epistaxis. Well, what else could epistaxis be? Well, it's only a nosebleed, but it's like a whole different vocabulary. And that disconnect has, I think, created a issue with our trust in the public, and this issue of overtreatment now has further strained the public trust that medicine has had. You know, it's a great job. It's a great profession. You're in healthcare, and every day you see folks have tremendous results. The byproduct of phenomenal advances in technology and the art of medicine with compassion. I mean, it is a great profession. But when we've got the Institute of Medicine saying 30% of the time we miss the mark, we've got to study this. We've got to make it a discipline of science and say, how can we look at this like we would look at cancer? Where are the cracks? Where are the mistakes? And how can we streamline care? And that was the main reason I decided to write Unaccountable.
So that statistic of 30% problems of quality, waste, variability is a stunning statistic. Why do you think that you mentioned culture a little while ago. What is it about the culture of healthcare where those types of activities have been allowed to go on for such a length of time. Because if you look at any other industry, a 30% waste or 30% error rate really would be unacceptable. How does that occur within healthcare and medicine?
You know, it's a great wonder why people tolerate 30% waste in healthcare, but they wouldn't tolerate it in any other industry. I saw a statistic recently, it was in the Institute of Medicine report. The average income of an American in the United States has gone up about 30% over the last decade. Well, the increase in healthcare costs that they are paying have gone up about 68% over the same time period. Essentially, we've offset increases in income with increased healthcare costs. So you wonder, why is it that we tolerate this? And I have talked to business leaders that say, you know, every contractor we pay, we have some metric of how well they perform, except for one, healthcare. We keep throwing money at it. And patients say the same thing with their premiums and their new high deductibles. We keep throwing money at it. What more am I getting? What are we getting for our money? There's been this culture of medicine that has respected the art of individual autonomy, but at the great risk that some best practices never get standardized. In my own field of pancreas auto transplant, where we take a pancreas out of somebody, treat the cells and give the cells back to the patient. We need a laboratory to treat the cells. Well, Medicare at one point paid a bonus $20,000 payment to hospitals for doing this on top of what they were already charging. It became a very profitable business. Now, we have a laboratory at Johns Hopkins in the operating room, and we have the patient asleep under anesthesia, take the pancreas out, treat the cells, give the cells back right then and there, same operation. Hospitals across the country started doing this operation, taking the pancreas out, but because they don't have a laboratory, put it into a cooler, send it by jet to another city, have it treated at another facility in another city or state, have it flown back, and then cut the patient open up again for a second operation. Why would anyone have that procedure done? They just don't know about the other option. Now, I'm not talking about tiny hospitals. I'm talking about two of the U.S. News & World Report top 10 hospitals in the country do this. I mean, we've got smart people, good people, working in a bad system where these financial incentives lure people to do things that just aren't right. And I think if hospitals are accountable for their results, if the patient satisfaction scores, the patient outcomes, the complication rates, the volumes, the readmission rates, all the basic metrics of healthcare performance that doctors are endorsing as valid, if they were available to the public, people could choose where to go based on who performs the best, like any other free market works and like any other free market uses to reduce waste in their field.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So the issue of patient choice about where they seek care has been one that's been, you know, out there in the certainly in the healthcare literature and discussions amongst leaders for a number of years, and where many people advocate that if indeed patients had the opportunity to see the quality data, to see individual physician performance, hospital infection rates, et cetera, that they would naturally gravitate to those institutions. And there's another school of thought that says you can put all the information out there, but that won't really happen. Patients are going to naturally gravitate to. And you reference in your book where patients seek their care. I go there because my mother was born there or because it's 2 miles from my house. Talk to me a little bit about the balance there and how, if indeed quality is a factor, how do we get patients informed as to how they can seek this information, and really will it make a difference in where they seek care?
Well, you know, I've got some patients that tell me, "Doc, whatever you want to do, you just tell me and I'll do it." And they have total blind trust in the doctor and the system. And maybe for them, that's okay. But, you know, more and more patients now, they want to know the options. They want to know if something can be done minimally invasive, if they really need to take a medication, or if there's a holistic or naturalistic or preventive means. Maybe they can do physical therapy to avoid something. They want to know now. We've got an informed public, and increasingly we're seeing that. Now, one critic of the book told me, you know, if you put stuff out there, people will never use it, and it won't reduce healthcare waste. Well, 4 weeks after the book came out, a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that when there was public reporting of heart procedures, we're talking about stents and angiograms, the overall number of procedures went down by 14%, and there was no difference in patient outcomes. Big study, JAMA, about 4 weeks after the book came out, showing that public reporting reduces waste and has no impact. Patients did just as well. So I think increasingly we're learning about the impact of public reporting. And look, all of us know doctors who should not be practicing. I mean, at one national conference I was at, Lucian Leap asked the audience, how many of you know of a doctor who shouldn't be practicing because they're too dangerous? Every single hand went up. Everybody knows of some. And I think because we all recognize that there's going to be some bad apples that are going to really respond to financial incentives, and that there's little accountability in general in healthcare. A hospital about 7 miles down the street from my hospital had a doctor put in at least 500 unnecessary heart stents. Now, if those procedures would have been recorded and given to the patient on a thumb drive, as I advocate in the book Unaccountable, that doctor wouldn't have gotten away putting in stents in arteries that were never even blocked. There would have been some oversight, just like when we have speed traps with cameras at an intersection, everybody follows the law. I mean, the compliance rate with trying to get everyone to follow the speed limit for decades has been horrific. I mean, since we've had automobiles, we've been trying to do education. Education doesn't work to get people to follow the speed limit. What works is when somebody sees a camera or an officer on the side of the road, then everybody is compliant. And I think we in healthcare have a lot of room to increase accountability. And quite frankly, I think it'll really restore the trust that's been broken with the general public.
So let's go back to the culture question again. So I was riveted when I was reading the book about your account of when you were with Lucian in that room and everybody raised their hand. And in fact, as you describe it, you were hesitant at first to raise your hand. And there was a senior physician next to you who kind of looked at you and said, really, you don't know anyone? And then you did. But what about the culture of medicine do you think has led us to this point of where we actually know that harm may be occurring or have a sense of it, that we've gotten to this point where people are afraid to speak up, afraid to criticize their peers or the institution. You make a point a number of times in the book that, and in actually your opening chapter, where you talk about the fact that, go to where the people in healthcare, the nurses and the doctors and the administrators at that hospital, where they would seek the care. How does the culture, if you will, proliferate what you've been talking about? And for the public, how do they seek that information out?
You know, I once told a friend the best way to find out about the quality of a hospital is to ask an ER nurse who works there. A nurse knows more about the quality of a hospital than probably anyone else there. And for that matter, in any industry, a frontline worker providing the services, be it sales or creating products, probably knows more than any of the administrators at that institution about the culture. And the reason is that culture drives everything we do. You know, in economics, there's this phrase, no one has ever washed a rental car because they don't own it. So why would they? And the sense of owning the delivery of care is of critical importance in healthcare. You know, that's what bothers me about seeing the statistics now that 46% of us doctors in the United States are burned out, according to the Mayo Clinic that did a study 3 weeks ago. When we've got 46% of frontline providers in any industry burned out, of course the quality is going to be variable. Of course mistakes are going to happen. Of course people are going to fall through the cracks. When people don't feel that they own the service, that they, you know, docs tell me when I go to conferences and speak, you know, I often know how to make healthcare better at my institution. I know how to make the care safer for patients. I just don't feel anyone listens to me. I don't feel empowered. And that, I think, is one of the great divides right now in healthcare in the United States. Increasingly, we have some doctors saying at some facilities that there's a chasm between themselves and their unit manager, between themselves and those who are making the policies or those calling the shots on a national level. They don't feel empowered. And I think we're seeing more variability because of that.
So you talk in your book about administrative crackdowns, if you will, where you get providers of care and senior administrative leaders working a little bit more together, or getting the administrators out from their cloistered offices, if you will. Talk a little bit about that and what you see the value of that being, as well as its impact, if you will, on the quality and safety.
Well, you know, we all want the same thing. Doctors, administrators, insurance companies, policymakers. You know, there's an astronaut from outer space who was asked, what does the Middle East look like from outer space? And the astronaut said, you know, there are no lines when you look at it. The lines are man-made. And that's what's going on in healthcare. The lines we've made in healthcare are man-made. We all want the same good for the public. We've got good people. They're just sometimes working in this artificial system. You know, we tell administrators, make a profit, fill your beds. So they make a profit and they fill their beds. We tell doctors, see more patients. So they see more patients. We tell surgeons, do more procedures and they do more procedures. Everyone seems like they're doing their job. But as Don Berg said, it's like the jobs are designed wrong. I mean, we've got good people. And, you know, when my dad was a practicing doctor at Geisinger Hospital, I remember this administrator named Ken Ackerman, who would come down and sit down with the docs. He just would walk down the hallway, plop himself right in their office and say, how's it going? What do you need to do your job better? Now, he wasn't a doctor, Ken Ackerman, but the doctors on the staff said that he was the administrator in a white coat. That's how they came to nickname him. He was in touch with the frontline providers. And you see in all kinds of industries, be it Lehman Brothers, be it a large corporation that is delivering a service that's multinational. When the administrators lose touch with the frontline folks, that's when bad things start to happen. That's when the accountability becomes a problem because there's no transparency. And that was really the impetus for writing Unaccountable.
So as a hospital president, you know, I'm always struck by the fact that if you want to know where the issues are, as you described, you go to the front line, you talk to those providers, you go to the ED, you go to the operating room nurses. But why do you think that we've, in many hospitals, perhaps become, there's been a separate differentiation or divide, if you will, between administrations and doctors? And does it have anything to do with incentives? You talked a little earlier about misaligned incentives, if you will. So what do you think?
You know, I've seen both extremes in the United States, and I talk about both extremes in the book. I mean, I recently learned of an emergency room that was built that was freestanding with no hospital attached to it. I mean, can you imagine you have a heart attack and you go to the emergency room and they don't have a hospital to put you in? They got to ship you across a floating bridge, across a lake to go to another hospital because that's their, you know, their associated hospital they admit patients at. This happens in the United States. This happened. And you see these doctors saying, this isn't right. And even sometimes the administrators will say, yeah, we know it's not rational, but that's the way we get paid. We get paid more for an emergency room visit than primary care. And you realize when things are disassociated, the care gets very dangerous. And then you see times when they're in harmony. You see when there's transparency of infection data, how the administrators talk to the individual providers specifically about infections. What do we need to do to get our infections down? I mean, this is a model of management for any industry. In the New York transparency experiment, when heart surgery outcomes were publicly reported, I tell a story that Mark Chasson described where they actually had administrators walk into the units and ask the doctors and nurses, what do we need to do to get our mortality down? They're asking nurses, why is our complication rate high and how can we decrease it? Now, you don't see that level of common mission around reducing complications, except when everything's aligned, there's transparency of the data, there's accountability at all levels for the performance, and people own the system. And I, you know, remember hearing the story of a nurse saying, we've never seen the CEO here in the cardiac ICU except when we had public reporting of heart surgery outcomes. And you realize these are old-fashioned concepts here. These are American concepts. They're not Republican or Democrat concepts. Transparency is an American value. We expect it of the White House. We expect it of Congress. We expect it of Wall Street. Sarbanes-Oxley will have a CEO go to jail if they misreport their earnings for a company. Yet in healthcare, it's almost like an island. It's almost as if you can misreport infections or there's not that level of transparency, and we treat it differently. We got to start treating healthcare like we do any other business to reduce the waste and reduce the cost for everyday Americans.
Oh, oh, over and over, we tried to get our message through. Over and over, we've been shut down by you. So over and over. together over. We'll do what we have to do, 'cause we want speak, co-op democracy, table, co-op democracy, vote, co-op democracy, speak, co-op democracy, table, co-op democracy, vote, co-op democracy. Plus we've got a cause that's true.
This co-op's your co-op, from the aisles of produce to the bulk bins gleaming. We're member owners, our voices matter. This co-op belongs to you and me.
We wanted a boycott, so we read the bylaws. We got the sign-on of 100 members. 49 of us refused to live.
My co-op, this co-op's your co-op, from the aisles of produce to the bulk bins gleaming. We're member owners, our voices matter. This co-op belongs to you and me.
The board took over, ignored the bylaws, refused to listen, wouldn't hear our voices.
But we're not stopping till the vote is taken.
Co-op's my co-op,
this co-op's your co-op,
from the house of produce to the bulletin's gleaming. Remember owners, our precious matter.
This co-op belongs to you and me.
Oh yes,
this co-op belongs to you and me.
And now for something completely different.